Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's not every day that we get to see the birth of a new country, but that appears to be what we're witnessing right now in South Sudan. Sudanese are at the polls in that region, voting in a referendum to decide whether Africa's biggest country should split in two. Polls will close tomorrow, and the South is widely expected to vote for separation. Joining us to talk about the significance of the events is John Prendergast, a co-founder of the Enough Project, which aims to end genocide around the world. We are also joined by Nisreen El-Amin, coordinator of the Support Darfur Project. She is originally from Sudan and lives here in New York City. Welcome to both of you to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
John, assume no knowledge, but a lot of interest on the part of our listeners. Can you start by explaining why people in South Sudan want their own country?
For the last 55 years, on and off, the southern Sudanese people have fought for independence from the larger country of Sudan. It's the lower third of the country, rich in oil. And they, in the course of those wars, they've lost millions of lives in their struggle for freedom. And against all odds, they signed a peace agreement in 2005, which sort of kicked the can down the field 6 years and said, okay, in 2011, we'll have a vote that will allow the southern Sudanese to determine their own future. And I don't think the people in the government in Khartoum ever thought that this would actually happen. Well, lo and behold, on January 9th, or the next days right up till today, the Southerners have been turning out in droves to vote for their future. And so it is really an assertion of will that is quite extraordinary and a positive and hopeful a sign at a time around the world where things are pretty bleak.
And is this relevant to the mission of your Enough Project, which aims to end genocide?
Sure. We work on conflict prevention, crimes against humanity, and you really couldn't find, the parallels to the war in southern Sudan, you know, over the last two decades are few and far between. I think Congo is probably the deadliest war in the world since World War II. Arguably, Sudan is the second deadliest. So were war to begin again between the north and south of Sudan, I think we would have spent, the world would have had to spend billions of dollars in cleaning up the mess. So we wanted to invest in preventing that resumption of war. And as the intelligence community in the U.S. said, that was the highest risk of genocide in the world. They assessed that last year for this year. So I think so far we've seen quite a positive beginning to this effort to finally implement the peace deal that was signed in 2005.
And listeners, I don't know if we have Sudanese immigrants listening or people with direct connections to people in any part of Sudan. There's a community in New York, but I know it's very small. But if you happen to be from it and happen to be listening right now, we would love to hear your voice on, first of all, whether you think secession is the right course, and tell everybody else what this means to you, to your community, to America, to the world. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we bring in Nisreen El-Amin. You've been talking to the Sudanese community here in New York, I gather, and you yourself are from northern Sudan. How do you feel about the idea of the South separating?
I feel like this is an incredibly exciting moment in the history of Sudan, not just for the people of southern Sudan, but really for anyone who supports their self-determination and wants peace and justice in the region. And just, you know, 2 million lives were lost during the struggle that led up to this moment, and many more people were separated from their families. So people aren't just voting this week for separation, but also to honor all those people who sacrificed their lives during the war. And I think it's, you know, particularly significant for us in the north. I look at this sort of with mixed emotions. On the one hand, I feel very hopeful and inspired by Southern Sudanese people inching closer towards their dream for self-determination, but I also feel like this needs to serve as a wake-up call for the rest of us in the North to step up our efforts to push for democratic change within Sudan and to really make real the vision for Sudan that the leaders of the Southern Sudanese Liberation Movement had originally seen. And you know, because the Sudan that they want, which is a Sudan in which people have real representation in government, where people, everyone is benefiting from the country's oil wealth, is you know, a Sudan where people can be respected and live freely, practice their religion freely, regardless of where they're from, is a Sudan that a lot of us in the North want.
I introduced you, Nasreen, as coordinator of the Support Darfur Project. This is not directly about Darfur. This is not Darfur seceding, correct?
No, this is not directly about Darfur, but it's connected in the sense that the same demands being made you know, to the government of Sudan that were made by the southern Sudanese during this liberation struggle are very connected to the demands currently made by Darfurians as well.
And let's take a phone call. Ed in Manhattan. Ed, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, John. This is Ed Rezor, and I just wanted to bring you the warmest thanks and greetings from Bishop Karide Taban, who says now he can go in peace after 64 years of working on this for his people.
Thank you.
There's no way I can explain to your listeners how amazing this is for the Southern Sudanese. I suggest they go to SudanVoteMonitor.com and get on the internet and see what the Southern Sudanese are saying themselves. The other thing I would like to say as an American is this was.
But I gather, by the way, that you spent a lot of time in Sudan.
I've been working there on and off for 36 years, and I speak Dinka and a little bit of Arabic and the other languages.
Mm-hmm.
And besides being married by Bishop Karide Taban, who John knows, I was a good acquaintance of Dr. John Garang and studied agriculture as he did. But I think what Americans need to know, and it's really very much like President Obama's speech in Tucson, when Americans work on something together, as we did particularly under the second President Bush, but even before that under Clinton and others, but particularly under second President Bush with the follow-up by President Obama, we have achieved this, helped the Sudanese and the Africans achieve something really amazing. And I was at the signing of the peace agreement in 2005, and Colin Powell got the loudest applause except for John Garang. And I turned to my friends who were priests from the Diocese of Tarit, and I said, this is really nice because he's an African-American to have him get this applause. And they said, Ed, we don't want to disappoint you, but the people are not applauding for Colin Powell. They're applauding for George Bush. And this just tells you, you know, what America can accomplish mm-hmm. if we stick by our principles and we persist and we work together on stuff that supported by all branches of the American political spectrum, Senator Brownback and others.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it. As we talk about the Sudan secession vote, which is supposed to conclude tomorrow in South Sudan, with John Prendergast, the co-founder of the Enough Project, which aims to end genocide, and Nasreen El Amin, coordinator of the Support Darfur Project. She's originally from Sudan and lives here in New York. John, just before the vote, Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir said the South does not have the the ability to provide for its citizens or create a state or authority. And at very least, my understanding is that South Sudan is incredibly poor, and you don't usually see impoverished areas trying to break away. Honestly, you tend to see better-off areas trying to secede so they don't have to deal with the impoverished areas that they're attached to. Is that the case? Is South Sudan able to provide for its citizens once it sets up its own state, and is it seceding in some way, despite that challenge?
So
something that Nasreen said earlier, I think, is the key to the answer that question. She spoke about, in effect, the need for the next step, the democratic transformation of Sudan. And so what does that mean, in practical terms for Southern Sudanese? It means that the government that will steer the country into its first stage of independent statehood, if it transparently manages the huge amount of resources that the oil deposits provide this new country, and if it governs in a inclusive manner so that the internal divisions that every new state has to deal with are not match boxes that erupt, ignite, small and medium-sized fires that end up undermining the whole prospect of a peaceful state. If they can do the inclusivity and the transparency right, we got a great chance that this could be a state that succeeds well. And I want to reinforce what Nasreen said, that goes for the north as well. The northern part of Sudan, when the separation occurs between south and north, will have much less resources to govern with, because a lot of the oil will head south and into the southern coffers. And there is a tremendous yearning on the part of the Sudanese people for inclusive governance, for a pluralistic, democratic governance, and no more of this authoritarianism that has marked Sudan for the last 21 years. So I think that key is democracy. It sounds so simple, but and we have a lot to do with how we can support and promote people's movements to help Sudanese people's movements to help bring about the day, both in the south and the north, where people will have a say in how their government is run.
So, Nasreen, what's the role of oil in all of this? And do I have it right that the south has the oil, basically, but the north, of course, has the port? So for either of them to benefit from the presence of oil, they will have to cooperate with each other?
Yes, absolutely. If and when the south secedes, 80% of Sudan's oil will be controlled by the south, which means that the northern government is going to be losing about 70% of its current oil revenues. And that's significant. As of right now, there's a backlash. I find President Bashir actually announced price increases right before the referendum, sort of in preparation for this loss in oil revenues and these price increases in fuel and sugar in particular. And that affected the region of Darfur quite negatively, where people are, where basic food items prices have gone up, and people are relying on food delivery through trucks, and that's becoming more difficult with these fuel increases. But of course, again, what you just said is correct, which is that oil is a point of contention, and it's a point of potential continued tension in the future, but it's also an opportunity for cooperation, because currently the northern government, controls the infrastructure and the technology to export the oil. There are, of course, other companies that are interested in taking the oil from the south out through Kenya and other countries, and that's, something that needs to still be looked at going forward and discussed and negotiated.
Nasreen, is there much of a Sudanese expat community here in our area, and is this reverberating among them in New York and vicinity?
Yeah, there's a significant community. I think there's a larger community in Washington, D.C. I actually have friends from Northern Sudan who went down to on Sunday to stand at the polls in solidarity with their Southern Sudanese brothers and sisters to celebrate at the polls with them. And I was also just last night talking to a friend of mine in Boston who was saying people came from far away in buses, arrived in the morning on Sunday to vote. Some were stuck in a snowstorm and, were hosted by various people in the community, and people were doing carpooling and helping each other out with childcare to make sure that everybody, is able to cast their vote.
Before you go, we usually hear this cast as the Arab North and the Christian South of Sudan. Is that the right way to look at the context of the Civil War? Was it about religion or just religious difference or ethnic difference, or was it more about resources?
In my opinion, ethnicity and religion do play a role. There's an Arab-Islamic hegemony that's been imposed on the country. But one thing to keep in mind is that the north of Sudan, as it stands now, if the south secedes, will still be majority indigenous African. It'll be majority Muslim, whereas the south currently has about 5% Christians. As a whole in the country, southern Sudanese, 5% of the country is Christian, and most of those are in the south, and about 25% are animist. But in the north, so the majority in the north are Muslim, but they don't necessarily adhere to the practices and interpretations of Islam that the ruling elite has put forth. So there's issues around being able to practice their faith freely in their own way. But also, I think at the root of what we're talking about is really the lack of distribution of wealth and political power in the country. There's a ruling elite that controls all of the wealth. I mean, to me, there's no excuse that a country that exports 490,000 barrels of oil a day, in a country like that, that there are people who have to travel long distances to get to a doctor, that there's 80% illiteracy rates among women in Darfur. These are all things that a country that has oil should not be dealing with anymore. 40% of the population, for example, doesn't have access to safe water. So we're talking about really a need for development in these marginal regions and for real political representation mm-hmm. of the majority of the country who are indigenous African.
And John, in our last minute, I gather that you were there looking at the voting process earlier, as was George Clooney, and that both of you were so concerned about the threat of violence in the run-up to the vote that you helped launch what's called the Satellite Sentinel Project. Tell us about your work with George Clooney and how that has gone. I know there has been some killing during this week of voting.
Yeah, we've been out to southern Sudan a couple times in the last 3 months and asked basically to do two things. One is to put a spotlight, to the extent that we could bring it, particularly George, that focuses right on that referendum and the date that only the southern Sudanese believed was possible. The rest of the world thought, they'll never have this vote on time. They'll never have it credibly. And the southern Sudanese believed, and we got behind them, and we just did our best to try to make sure that vote happened. Secondly, though, we wanted everybody to keep their eyes on these contentious issues, particularly along the border. There's a region of southern Sudan, right on the border of southern Sudan and northern Sudan, called Abyei, which is sort of Sudan's Kashmir. And it is a contested area that was supposed to have a referendum itself, concurrent with the southern referendum, didn't have it. And now this is where most of the violence that you referred to is occurring. So we've trained satellites on some of these really vulnerable areas. We're already getting imagery. We're doing the analysis of the imagery, and we'll start to publish that, not to do anything but prevent or deter, I guess, the use of violence to achieve political ends. And so it's an experiment, basically. Citizens saying, let us do our part to contribute to a prevention of a war before it starts, rather than waiting to clean up the mess afterwards. And since the UN is prevented from going to some of these areas because the government of Sudan doesn't want them to see what they're doing, well, we'll just go ahead and contract satellites in the sky mm-hmm. to try to take some pictures and see if we can't expose what's going on.
Well, that vote is expected to end tomorrow. And listeners, as you've been hearing, this historic referendum for independence in South Sudan at what is hoped to be the end of the decades-long civil war in Sudan has ramifications for self-determination, for economic justice, for religious freedom, for an end to genocide. John Prendergast, co-founder of the Enough Project, and Nasreen El Amin, a coordinator of the Support Darfur Project, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, as Martin Luther King weekend is approaching, we will play clips from one of his last and seldom heard speeches which was about, among other things, sanitation workers' rights. Sanitation workers in the news in New York right now, ironically. And we'll explore King's legacy with public employee unions. Some fascinating King clips with a historian coming up next.